Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Gather 100 Texans in a room, and 76% will admit they have watched a friend or family member struggle with a mental illness. So why do 90% of us still find it harder to talk about health issues that affect our brains than those that affect our bodies? And why do nearly a third of us worry we wouldn't know where to find help for ourselves or a loved one with a mental health condition? Tom Luce is president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, which this year released results of its survey, Texas State of Mind, about how Texans feel about mental health issues. You can find it online in its entirety at texasstateofmind.org. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
What was the primary purpose of conducting a survey like this, and what kind of sampling did you do around the state?
Well, the purpose of it really was we want to improve the entire mental health system in the state. And part of that is understanding where people's minds are about mental health, how to deal with it, willingness to deal with it, because ultimately we want to change the way the system works. So we're going to need to understand not only the consumer mind, but also are they willing to speak up to change the system.
76% of Texans have had a close friend or family member experience mental illness. The survey didn't even ask, have you yourself experienced a mental illness? Is it safe to say awareness of mental health is no longer a problem?
I think that's fair to say, unfortunately. I think awareness has grown, but the stigma has not disappeared. But I really feel like that can change. I'm old enough to remember when Betty Ford announced, she was first lady at the time, said she had breast cancer. And in those days, women didn't use the B word or the C word. And because of that, we began to talk about it as a society. Same thing happened with AIDS. For years, we were in denial. But eventually, the public said, we've got to do something about this.
I was struck by the figure in the survey that 88% of Texans agree we should do something about the stigma, which it would seem that a number like that would say there is no longer a stigma. Are people afraid, maybe irrationally afraid, that other people will look down on them if they admit to having a mental illness?
I think, unfortunately, that's still true. I think we're afraid of it socially. We're afraid of it in the workplace. So I think we have a long way to go. Now, you know, we've made progress. I will say this. It's clear that we have generational gaps. I mean, my generation, nobody talked about mental health. There wasn't even much awareness because we just didn't talk about it. But each generation, and among the younger generation, I don't see nearly as much stigma, and I see total awareness. I mean, you ask a young person, they feel very free to say, well, Joe's my roommate and Joe's bipolar and we got to make sure Joe took his medicine today. And it's just kind of not a big deal to the younger generation. So there's hope that attitudes are going to change because this really is, you know, we need to treat this as any other health problem because that's what it is.
There's been interesting reporting recently about parity laws and how they don't quite go as far as they were intended to in terms of guaranteeing that people have access through their insurance companies to mental health care.
They absolutely do not. This was brought to my mind in a very personal way. I was speaking to a group of doctors and other healthcare professionals about 6 months ago, and we were talking parity. And I happened to say I've got to leave early because I've got to go to a rehab session, meaning I'd had a stent put in to unblock an artery. And one of them said, well, don't want to offend you, Tom, but it looks pretty clear you're on Medicare. He's right. I was old enough to be on Medicare. And he said, I happen to know when you're on Medicare and you've had a stent put in, Medicare pays 24 for you to go to 24 sessions of rehab to make sure you're getting in the condition you need to be so you don't have another stent put in. Well, one of the doctors raised their hand and said, well, guess what? If you'd been in and diagnosed with a severe mental illness, we wouldn't pay for you to go 24 sessions to make sure you stay on your medicine and do what you're supposed to do or go in for your appointments. That's not parity. And we really don't have parity. It's the law, but we haven't gone through the tussle of really defining what parity means.
Well, I guess there's this loophole of the question of medical necessity, and it's a little bit harder for reasons that don't quite make sense if you have a professional diagnosing a mental illness, but somehow it's harder to convince insurance companies that you really need treatment for your depression than that you really need treatment for your, you know, dislocated shoulder.
Yeah, and but there's no medical reason for that. That's simply insurance companies dragging their feet, and I understand that. I mean, we're behind the times. But also, we need to change the system so that we can produce better data for governments and insurers to say, here's what works, here's what doesn't work, you know, and we're not very good yet at defining and really holding people accountable for the types of treatment that they've gotten and doing the studies that will enable us to say these are best practices in dealing with bipolar or depression or schizophrenia, you know, so there's a lot of work to be done. So this isn't just an insurance and government problem. It's a problem really in the profession. And one of the huge issues we face in this state, which is true in every state, we don't have nearly the professional workforce we need. I think the latest number I saw in 174 of the 254 counties in this state did not have a single psychiatrist or psychologist residing in that county. Hmm. Now, you know, if you had an insurance company willing to pay, it doesn't necessarily mean that help is available where people are.
What does it take to recruit these folks to want to come and live in Texas, particularly in underserved rural areas?
Well, the first thing, we have leakage occurring. By that, I mean we have medical school graduates who want to be psychiatrists or psychologists, and the state does not fund enough intern residencies to keep those students in Texas. So they leave the state to get their residency, and then guess what? They stay there. Well, the first thing is we need to keep our homegrown talent. And then it's like any other healthcare issue. You may have to incentivize people to serve in rural areas or underrepresented areas, whether it be with loan forgiveness or incentives to practice there. So, you know, it's not easy. But the good news is, and I'm cautiously optimistic right now, and part of that is because healthcare is in turmoil. And my experience tells me when you're trying to change a large system, at least if it's in chaos, you've got a chance while it's forced to change that you can bring some changes that are for the better.
Texans are more concerned about the state of the mental health care system than about the state of the education system, which in a state that worries about education as much as Texas, that's saying something.
It is. And, you know, I've been a huge public education advocate for 30 years. And, you know, to me, they both stand side by side is really, you know, it's kind of the traffic circle, if you will, for all Texans. There's an intersection with most of us, either through the healthcare system or the school system, mm-hmm. one or the other. And those are the two places where we can do the most to improve the quality of life of all Texans and also the productivity. I mean, to me, this is about we need a healthcare system that really will enable each of us to maximize our God-given talents. And if there are barriers in the way, we need to help remove those.
Lots of people, encouragingly, I think something like 70 to 80% said if they were in a position to hire and they had a candidate who had been or was being successfully treated for a mental illness, that would not be an impediment. On the other hand, I wonder about things like absences. You know, you can call in and say, I've got the flu today, I can't come in. It seems as if there would be less acceptance if you called in and said, I'm sorry, my depression is really getting the best of me today and I can't come in.
Yeah, and that's part of the social stigma, if you will, that I think we need to deal with. But we need to recognize, and, you know, one of the unfortunate side effects of the fact that our veterans are dealing with post-traumatic stress is it's forcing the public to see in very clear colors that stress, depression, post-traumatic stress is not a character flaw. It's not. You can't look a veteran in the eye and say, well, just pull yourself up by the bootstraps and just tough it out. I mean, it's making us come face-to-face with the fact that post-traumatic stress and other mental health issues really are real in the brain. It's not a character flaw. And that's an important step in society dealing with this, that it really is, you know. And, but part of it is also our healthcare system. I think we need what's called an integrated healthcare system, where we really talk about medicine to the whole person. If you go see your doctor, you ought to be able to get treatment for your mental or your physical health problems. Right now, it's kind of like, well, gee, if you've got a mental health problem, why don't you go down the street? You determine if that's where you need to go. And if you have a physical health care, you go over here and you determine where to go. That doesn't take care of medicine to the whole person. And what we know through research is that very, very often mental health issues are driving physical health issues. So you take a population at Parkland, we know through research that we may say the patient's coming in to be treated for diabetes or OPCD, but the underlying issue, which is preventing them from making improvement, may be a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. And until we decide we have to deal with the medicine to the whole person, that person's really not going to get better.
What stops primary care physicians from, when they're asking about sleep habits and whether somebody drinks and how they eat and how much exercise they get, from asking about mental health?
Well, a lot of it, I think, just goes back to their perception and their medical school training, that they're a primary physical health care doctor. And also, I think physicians, particularly primary care doctors in large portions of our state, are like consumers. They wouldn't know where to send somebody if the person said it was could self-diagnose themselves to say, I have severe depression. That's an extreme to say none of them would, but not all of them, our doctors would know where to send them for help, particularly if they needed financial help. And one thing to always keep in mind, mental health does not recognize zip codes. I mean, it impacts people of all strata of income, social classes, economic classes, you name it, it impacts everybody.
So there's the issue of some people just don't even know where to find care. And then when you need a mental health practitioner, it's a little bit different than needing a cut stitched up. You might not be able to stand the person who stitches up your cut, but you can get better after that session. Whereas you really have to very often form a relationship with a healthcare provider, a mental health care provider.
You're right. And yet our insurance system doesn't allow you the time to establish that relationship. Let me share with you another problem. Of all things, you know, the largest psychiatric hospitals in the state are the Harris County jails and the Dallas County jails. And they may dispense, and the amount of money our jails spend on drugs to deal with mental health issues is enormous, because that's the only thing they really know what to do is to prescribe medicine. But guess what? Under current law, once you've been in jail, you lose your Medicaid coverage. So when you come out of jail, guess what? You can't go get the medication you need. And you've lost your insurance, so you can't go back to where you were and build back up that relationship. That doesn't make any economic sense.
We're speaking this hour with Tom Luce, who is president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, which recently released a survey, Texas State of Mind. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, Tom Luce. The institute recently issued a survey called Texas State of Mind. It's about how Texans feel about mental health issues. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Tom, a big takeaway from this is that a significant majority of Texans surveyed, 67%, approved spending more money and specifically more tax money to address mental health needs. This is very surprising in a state like Texas, where we want to keep our tax bills as low as is humanly possible.
Yes, and of course, I think that's a very, very hopeful sign that people realize, you know, if you really bring this down to what do we need to accomplish, it is if you know a friend or a family member or you yourself know you have a mental health issue, we need a system that can ensure that you can get help when you need it and where you need it and you can afford it. Because the cost to society of not doing that is enormous. Going back in the previous segment, we were talking about jails and how people lost their Medicaid. I talked to a county judge in an urban county in this state, and he told me he had a list of more than 1,000 people who are what he calls frequent flyers, which means each of them had been arrested 60 times or more and put in county jail and then released. I mean, that doesn't help the person. It doesn't help society. It doesn't help the taxpayers. That's just a system that's got to be cured. And so we have to be able to know to where to send people and how to get help. But the state's not doing their job. I've served on the Sunset Commission that reviewed the Health and Services Commission this year, and we found that agency has over 100 websites that you should, quote, go to if you needed help. Well, guess what? If you're really overwhelmed and need help and we want you to navigate 100 different websites, that's not really going to help somebody.
There's also the question, coming back to this issue of stigma. Occasionally you'll have like someone who is running for public office and then the opposition will come out and say, well, 12 years ago, this person was in treatment for whatever. Nobody goes back and says 12 years ago, this person had a kidney problem or whatever. Is there something about the way we assume that once a person has struggled with mental illness, that means they are always on the verge of falling back into really a crisis situation?
Yeah. Yes, it is, and that's part of what we also have to cure. And we are seeing nationally, and we've seen in this state, that candidates have gotten elected who have been treated in the past for mental health issues. And what we need to understand is that, for instance, in heart disease, you may be under care for 10, 15, 20 years. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And so that's where we need to get in mental health. But we're not there yet. But we really should get there where we understand, again, we're talking about a healthcare issue. This isn't anything else but a healthcare issue.
So we've discovered that Texans are overwhelmingly in support of spending more money and potentially more tax money on mental health care. Is there evidence that the more we spend, the better the result?
Not sufficient. And what I say, and I learned this in public education, if you're going to ask the state government for more money, then in all fairness, you need to be able to say to them, here's what research shows is the best way to spend that money. Here are the best practices, for instance, in dealing with alcohol and drug abuse. Here are the best practices in dealing with bipolar disorder. So we need more research, and then we need to have the state incentivize people to perform the best practices and counties to carry out the best practices. I'll give an example back to this jail discussion, but some counties on their own have had sheriff's departments have used county tax dollars to hire mental health professionals to be part of their police force who go out on calls because they believe it may save the life of their officers and it may save putting a person in jail when that person really needs to be in an out treatment facility for mental health. Well, shouldn't the state, when giving money for mental health, maybe incentivize a county to do that rather than to treat them in jail? So, you know, we need to discuss and we need to be realistic. You know, taxpayers want to know they got their money's worth, and we all want to know we got our money's worth. So we need to look at the research, and we need to do what we can to ensure that those dollars are spent wisely.
We've had heartbreaking conversations on this show and other contexts with people who essentially had to call the police on a loved one in order to get them committed for the care that they needed. Otherwise, they could not receive care.
Yes, and that's a, you know, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who have had to confront that situation. But part of that is due to the fact that we have a system, in my judgment, the way I characterize it, our mental health system operates on what I call an emergency room basis. We wait till there's an emergency, and then we get you some help. On the physical health care side, we would at least purport to say we're into prevention. We're not perfect at it, but we would at least say it's the job to prevent you from having a heart attack, not just wait till you have one. Well, we've got to do the same thing in mental health. We've got to get people help, and there's research shows that you can treat and improve people's lives if you deal with what I call treatment before tragedy.
What does that look like? How do you identify people who are basically functional today, but given more stress and no treatment, will get worse in a year or 6 months or whatever the case may be?
We need to train more people who really can do a mental health checklist in their mind, train more doctors, nurses, school officials who really can help identify early on and encourage people to get help early on as opposed to sending them home or suspending them from school or putting them in a juvenile justice system. Our answer today to that is to put them in a juvenile justice system when we know many people develop mental health symptoms when they're a child and they progressively get worse.
Lots of Texans approved of the idea of giving children access to mental health services within schools. And we have on most campuses now a school counselor, but this person is in charge of a lot of things beyond mental health. They do some disciplinary stuff. They do some, special like academic services. Do we need to separate those functions out so that the people providing mental health services are focusing only on that?
Well, that would certainly help a great deal. And whoever is doing that, whether it's, quote, the school counselor or mental health counselor, the most important thing is we need to have facilities and options for them to send children to get some help. And right now, the state, and it's understandable, and I'm glad they did, but for the past 25 years, we've spent a large portion of our mental health budget in improving what I call the crisis intervention side of mental health. But now we need to move to more of the daycare is not the right word, but a treatment where you can get help without being picked up by law enforcement. And we need to have outpatient treatment where you can get help before it's an emergency. But again, that counselor has to have a place to refer you to that will be effective.
What do we know about the individuals in Texas who would even consider a career as a mental health service provider?
Well, we know it's difficult to recruit people for the mental health field right now. A lot of people believe that's because, again, of how we reimburse people who go into the mental health field versus how we reimburse surgeons. I'm not picking on surgeons. I'm just saying rates are different for a counseling session. And we need to take a look at our rate structure, and we need to take a look at making sure that people know if they go into that field that there is insurance reimbursement that can help their practice, so to speak. So it's a combination of factors, and it won't be easily solved, but you've got to attack all of those factors.
The VA has looked at loan forgiveness for young people who want to become psychiatrists and then do some service for the military. Does something like that make sense for something as large as the state of Texas? Could we look at making it cheaper to go to school to get your degree in psychology or even psychiatry?
Absolutely. And there are several bills before the legislature now to do that. And that's a very important step that we need to take. We need, again, the way I look at the best way for state government to operate is to provide incentives to do better things. And that's one of the things we can do is incentivize people. It's not mandating that anybody do anything. But if we can encourage a young person by saying, we'll forgive your school loan, then absolutely. And I think it society benefits and they benefit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Let's go on the phone now to Lindsay in Fort Worth. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Chris. I love your show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment. I am a college student, and my fiance is Morgan. I'm very blessed to be able to be on her income and her insurance, but you know, the speaker is very correct. You know, I've been off my anxiety meds for 2 years now, and partially because it was a conscious choice to get off meds, but the other part of it is that a psychiatry visit on even the best insurance is $250, and as a college student, you just can't afford that. And, you know, any follow-up visits, they don't give you, you know, 6 months worth of, you know, anxiety medicine. They give you a month, and then it's $125 every single month. Hmm. And it's just the healthcare system and the mental health care system is just so exorbitant. It's really challenging to get the care you need.
Thanks so much for your call, Lindsay. And I'm sorry that you've struggled with that, but it sounds like something that a lot of people could relate to.
Absolutely. And that's back to the parity issue. I mean, we've got to make sure that, again, that the way we treat mental health is the same we would treat physical health. And it's not the same if you don't allow people to get sufficient help to get better. But we've got to grapple with what exactly does parity mean? And I hope that we at the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute can be a leader in that and help define what it is we want insurance companies to do. Now, again, taxpayers are going to want to know that the services that are being provided are making a difference, and I don't blame them. But that's why we need outcome metrics. That's why we need to know if a person goes to this type of drug rehab program, it produces less return visits than another one. I mean, we need to measure how various programs are working and how good various providers are.
If I go to have my knee looked at, I'll probably see the orthopedist for about 10 minutes in the office, and then you'll see maybe a nurse, and then maybe you go and work with a physical therapist. But people who ostensibly are paid less but can still provide adequate care, is there a problem with the fact that, you know, if you need psychiatric care, you need, you know, 45 minutes or an hour of time with one individual who is, you know, at an MD level? That's expensive, and there aren't that many hours to go around when you divide out the number of professionals out there.
Yes, and I think that's one of the many workforce issues we're going to have to deal with is how I by background, I used to be a lawyer. I say I'm in step 11 of a 12-step process. I'm a recovering lawyer. But when I was practicing law, you know, I saw eventually the paralegal role grow greatly. Mm-hmm. I've seen in the physical health side the nurse practitioner role grow gradually. And I think the same thing has to happen in the psychiatry and psychologist role. I mean, we have to leverage more people. Or we just can't, there's not enough money to do what we need to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Beth in McKinney. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I just wanted to go ahead and tell you about my son. He's 6 years old. He's in Baker Elementary School in Prosper. and he's been having some issues. It's his first year of elementary school, and I cannot stop receiving phone calls from the principal and the teacher. They're just not able to help him enough, and we had the counselor help, but she can only do so much. Then when I try to set up an appointment with LifePath Systems, they don't take kids that are above 5 years old. And also my insurance has a $1,500 deductible, and I cannot get any mental help for him or any behavioral help. It's expensive. Schools cannot do anything. And on top of that, he's just not liking school. And I'm so frustrated. I don't even know what to do.
Well, unfortunately, that's not the first time that I've heard a story of that nature, and that's the reason why we exist, is to try to improve the system so this lady would know where to turn for help in Prosper, Texas. And unfortunately, we just don't have sufficient treatment facilities. We don't have sufficient professionals, and we're just not getting the job done, and we're just way behind the curve. And it's frustrating because I know that awareness is growing of this issue, but it is a complex issue in fairness to the legislature, and they're trying to grapple with what do we do with this. But we have to move forward. I mean, you can hear stories like that all over the state. Everywhere I go, somebody comes up and says, let me tell you what's happened to me, and it's real.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Tom Luce, who's president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. It recently released a survey called Texas State of Mind about how Texans feel about mental health policy issues. You can see the whole thing online at texasstateofmind.org. Also, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us, think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute recently released a survey called Texas State of Mind about how Texans feel about mental health issues and the availability of care. We're speaking this hour with the president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, Tom Luce. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Tom, is there a state that is getting it right or that we might look to as a model for delivery of care and access to affordable care?
You know, I've asked that question of my policy experts, and I don't think any state is getting this right. And Texas really could be a leader in this regard. And I think one of the places we can start being a leader is in what we call smart justice. And we are finding unanimity on both sides of the aisle in Austin about the need to make sure that our prisons are not psychiatric hospitals. And that's a place to start. And then on the integrated healthcare side, nobody's really yet tackled the issue of what parity means. And that's notwithstanding the fact that the requirement of parity actually passed under President George W. Bush first. Then it was once again endorsed in the Affordable Care Act. But we really haven't yet dealt with as a society as to what do we mean parity should provide. And I think we can be a leader in that regard. But unfortunately, and I've asked, and we have a great policy team that's worked all over the country, nobody's in the lead on this, and it's because for too long we have treated mental health and physical health as two different things, and they're not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Aman in Arlington. Hi, Aman.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a psychology student at UC Arlington and about to graduate here. And the issues that I'm seeing is that there are only limited number of clinical psychology classes that are offered at universities. As even having a great GPA, it's difficult to get into clinical psychology programs.
I'm going to stop you there. And Aman, great question. We're having a little trouble hearing you. But from what I heard, you were saying that you're a student at UTA and there's a limited number of clinical psychology programs available at universities in Texas. Has that been your assessment as well, Tom?
Yes. And I think, though, he was also referring to medical schools. And we plan to hopefully challenge our medical schools in this country. I don't think they have reacted sufficiently to what parity means. In other words, has their curriculum for a primary care doctor changed significantly in the last 10 years? I think, unfortunately, the answer to that is no. And have they changed their residency, the internship, the residency in terms of how they deal with mental health and physical health? So, again, you know, we have a long way to go, but this is a undergraduate issue. It's a medical school issue, and it's not one that can be changed overnight, but we better get started.
Are Texans aware of the kinds of mental health hygiene practices that can keep us all in good shape? You know we're supposed to do certain things to take care of our mm-hmm. bodies. Do we think about what we need to do to take care of our brains?
Well, the answer is no, and the answer is, again, our system doesn't think about producing those prevention measures. Again, we operate on an emergency room basis. And that won't work anymore. It's too costly to society and it's too costly to individuals to wait until we have an emergency to respond. Just imagine if we still had a physical healthcare system that waited until you went to the emergency room to help you. We'd say, what are we doing?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jackie is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. My question was for Mr. Luce, addressing his comment earlier about how mental illness is purely a medical care issue, and I was wondering how we could address the stigma of mental illness as a whole, both outside of the medical care and also in society, as the layman, if you will.
Well, we have to have more people who are willing to step forward and talk about the issue. Again, I used breast cancer as the example. People step forward. They step forward on AIDS. We hope to conduct public service campaigns about mental health and the fact it's a healthcare issue. So we've got to attack the stigma frontally and actively, and we plan to do so. And I think, and you mentioned this earlier, Chris, I don't think it's any more an issue of awareness. It's more an issue now of eliminating the hesitancy or the stigma of admitting to somebody besides yourself that you need help. And we've got to make sure that we do that. And we're going to challenge communities all over the state to do that, employers, business groups, civic groups. We've got to understand that this is a healthcare issue that has to be dealt with.
Let's go next on the phone to Henry in Lake Dallas. Hello, Henry.
Hi. Along that line, I was calling because I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 1990 and have been under treatment ever since. And one of the things I've done has just been willing to talk about my condition openly, the fact that I was had that issue, and if the patients and the people suffering, I think, discuss it, and people will realize that it is a health problem, but you can deal with it with the proper treatment.
Henry, when you started, when you decided that you would speak openly about having bipolar disorder, did it feel like a risk, or did it feel like something that you wish you had hadn't waited to do?
I wasn't ever really ashamed of it. To me, it was obvious that I had a health issue, and it wasn't any kind of character flaw. It was just something that had to be dealt with like any other health issue that comes up. But, of course, with mental illness, you're hesitant to seek treatment because you don't want to realize the stigma is a social attitude, and it affects people who suffer from the illness too. But once you're under treatment, you realize it can be dealt with.
Anything there you want to respond to, Tom?
Just so thankful that he has that attitude and has spoken out, and we need more people to do that. I mean, he's a wonderful example, and it's so true. Again, I will say the promising thing is I find with younger people, I was visiting with somebody the other day, and she said, oh, yeah, my roommate's bipolar, and I try to make sure that she's remembered to take her medicine today. And it was just kind of a casual comment. I don't think you would have found many people my age, I'm in my 70s, that would have said that. And so I think it's changing. And that's for the good.
Do you feel like lawmakers in Texas are paying attention to this issue in a different way than they have in the past?
I do. And it's come about, unfortunately, it's come about because lawmakers have finally decided it's very expensive to continue to build jails and prisons. And so there is a consensus on both sides of the aisle that that really doesn't make sense. And I think that's caused it to happen. And then again, I think this generational thing, they hear from young people and they hear from their own children and their own grandchildren that, you know, we need to deal with mental health.
Sometimes when we have a very large, very visible tragedy in this country, people say, let's look at the mental health system. And I suppose there are pros and cons to that. On the one hand, it's always good when people talk about an issue that doesn't get enough discussion. On the other hand, maybe it puts in people's minds the idea that mental illness equals, you know, the horrible situation in which someone, you know, injures a whole lot of people, which is not the case for most people who are suffering every single day with mental illness. They're of no danger to other people. I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I think I'd use the example of the German Wings airplane crash. The facts are that we probably have 10% of the population in the United States that has a severe mental illness that would include depression. And yet the media is screaming headlines that said pilot has depression and thus he crashed the airplane. Well, he might have also been left-handed and had measles as an adult, but that wasn't what caused that crash. And depression was not a direct causation of that crash. There are millions of people in this country with depression that it never even crosses their mind to engage in mass murder or mass suicide. And so we have to be very careful in understanding that when we react to that tragedy, that we really do not accept right away a causation factor such as was headlined in that crash. That's not good for society to say, whoops, if you have depression, you may crash the airplane. There's lots of people flying airplanes that probably were treated for depression, and they don't crash airplanes.
Yeah, I was thinking about the repercussions on those individuals for being successfully treated, and they have a job, and yeah. Let's go back to the phones now. We'll speak this time to David in Denton. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I had a question for Tom. You had brought up the idea of making sure that prisons weren't mental health facilities. And, you know, ideally that would be perfect, but how would we define when a law has been broken or a person has been put in jail based upon mental health issues or not? And then how could we figure out who's in jail right now because of mental health issues that like caused them to break a law?
Well, I'm a firm. You have to enforce the law. If somebody robbed a bank and they had severe mental illness, they still need to go to jail. But the issue is, right now, we use the jail almost as a default option if somebody is disorderly on the street, or they're homeless on the street, or they're yelling at somebody. Instead of taking them to, they haven't really committed, they may have committed a misdemeanor, but they haven't committed a crime. And yet the default option is to put them in county jail because we don't know where to take them for treatment. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't have people in jail if they've committed crimes. Of course we should. But that, it's just too often a default position when we don't know what else to do.
When people who are incarcerated are receiving mental health medications, are they also getting some kind of counseling or talk therapy to go along with those psychotropic drugs?
Well, the answer is theoretically, but there may be one psychiatrist in 1,000 prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, not to the extent they should. But again, you know, if people commit crimes, they need to be in jail. But right now, we use the police department as a default option. When that lady you mentioned earlier, you know, finally called for an emergency, they call the police. There wasn't an emergency mental health team that she called to come help. It was a police officer. Well, when the police officer gets involved, you're inevitably in the justice system. And that police officer may or may not be qualified to make a diagnosis as to whether this is a mental health issue or not. And, of course, if somebody's life's in danger, you need to remove them. But where do you need to remove them to? Do you need to remove them to an outpatient facility or to a jail?
So for people who, whether they took the survey or not, agree that Texas should spend more money on mental health care, what do they need to do to make those feelings known?
Well, I've always told people the good news and bad news about democracy is you get what you deserve. So they need to write their legislator and say, you know, mental health is a real priority for me and we need to do something about it. And they need to speak out and be heard. And I know that sounds simplistic, but it matters if legislators hear from their constituents that this is an important matter. And it's one we think it's worthy of spending money on.
Tom Luce is president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, which conducted the survey Texas State of Mind about how Texans feel about mental health issues. You can find the whole thing online at texasstateofmind.org. Tom, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can send email to the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.